Okay, a pleasure to welcome back Shuli, of course. And by the way, Shuli will be speaking, in addition to Record Class, she'll be kicking off our Tisha B'Av program next Sunday, the 11 a.m. or 6 p.m. slot towards the end of the day in Israel. I'm talking about Beit Rishon, the period of the end of Beit Rishon. But we'll send out information about that later. And now we can get started on our regular schedule programming. B'vakasha, Shuli.
All right. Hi, everybody. So we are up to our fifth in our Walking the Land series. And today we are heading to the coast. We're going to go to the beach, which is always fun. Who doesn't like going to the beach? Okay. So we're going to take a look at various things. Today, the coast, we're going to see an amazing picture in a minute. Today, the coast is a very vital part of Israel. Major cities, the greatest ones being, of course, Tel Aviv and Haifa, but the whole area of what's called Gush Dan, right? This large complex of suburbs and cities in central Israel. Is how most people think of the coast today, plus a lot of tourism and beaches, like what you're seeing in the picture here. But what's interesting is that we're going to see the trajectory of the coast and how it changed over time. And essentially, from the entrance of the Israelites into the land of Israel, okay, from that point, basically, we see a kind of a bifurcation of the coast being one population and the mountains being another population. We, the Jews, right, the children of Israel, are the mountain population for centuries upon centuries, and the coast is a progression of various Gentiles. We'll see who. We'll take a look at a timeline. At a certain point, that flips, right? And that's really a fascinating thing, and that's what we're going to talk about and why that happens. Okay, the coast, of course, is the beaches of the Mediterranean, the coast of the Mediterranean. It's our window to the outside world. Okay, we'll talk about various ports that are there, and of course, today we have the airport, which is very close to the coast. We have the ports of Haifa and of Ashdod. And we also have the sea. And this is not going to be a main thing that we're going to talk about, but it's just interesting to notice both the Bible and the rabbis are very awed by the Mediterranean. Now, realize that they did not see, right, the people of Tanakh and the people of the Mishnah and the Gemara never saw the Atlantic, never saw the Pacific. So the Mediterranean is called the Yam HaGadol, the Great Sea. It is the most amazing, impressive sight that you can see. The only other bodies of water we have here are the little tiny Kinneret and the Jordan River. So the Mediterranean, Hayam HaGadol, or Hayam HaTichon, the Middle Sea, that's really literally a translation of the Mediterranean. But in Tanakh, we talk about the Yam HaGadol, Gadol, right, the great sea. And the sea is a metaphor in Tanakh for all different kinds of things, right? The sea is a metaphor for God's power, right? If God can bring something back from the depths of the sea, that shows you that only God could bring something back from the depths of the sea. It's a metaphor for infinity, right? The children of Israel are like the grains of sand, right? The power of the waves. It's used as a direction, right? We talk about Yama Vakedma means west and east. So it's a very significant part of how people oriented themselves in the ancient world. And it's also, of course, a border, right? The most obvious border in the land of Israel is the Mediterranean. Mediterranean is the main border, and we also have a kind of a vestige of this greatness. Okay, today we all know about the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, but there is still a special status to the Mediterranean. Where do we see that special status? We have a special blessing that you say only when you see the Mediterranean. I don't know if there are any rabbis who have talked about saying this when you see the Pacific, which is also an awesome ocean, but there definitely is a blessing if you have not seen the Yam HaGadol, the Mediterranean, for a month. You say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Oseh et Hayam HaGadol. Thank you, God. Blessed are you, God, who makes the great sea. So there is something significant about the Mediterranean already in Tanakh times, in rabbinic times, that we still have today, even though we're familiar with a larger world and with other bodies of water. Okay, let's go back to the land, right? The water is important, but let's go back to the land. First of all, let's just understand what we're talking about, right? When we talk about the coast, We're going to talk today about mostly about what's within the borders of the state of Israel, although Gaza down here also important because we're going to talk about the Philistines, right? And here's our coast of the land of Israel, right? Going along here, major up until Lebanon, major things to point out. Of course, let's do a little different color, right? We've got Ashkelon. Oh, that's not a good color. Sorry, experimenting. We've got Ashkelon, we've got Ashdod, we've got, of course, Tel Aviv. We've got, this is not proportional, don't use this as a map to drive with. Okay, we've got Haifa up here, Caesarea, Akko, right at the other end of the bay. All of these are significant cities and significant places along the coast. We're going to be discussing quite a few of them, so keep those in mind. The other thing that's interesting to notice, well, two other things that are interesting to notice. First of all, take a look at this amazing satellite picture here on the right, right? It's such a great picture. And what's wonderful about these satellite pictures is you really get a sense of where do people live and where do they not live, right? When you don't have lights, that's where people don't live. So here it's very clear from the satellite picture, which was taken recently, right, that the greatest concentration of population in Israel is along the coast. Right. Okay. You have Jerusalem over here, also very important. But the significant, the really bright places at night, Tel Aviv and the whole area around Tel Aviv, Haifa and the whole area around Haifa, that's where people are living, right? You have other places as well, but that's where people are living. Where are people not living? They're not living in the Negev, right? That's what you're seeing down here in the south. So that's just to give us a sense of modern Israel, those major population centers that are on the coast, and to take us back to ancient times for a minute. Okay? The coast is important, like so many things that we talk about in the land of Israel in ancient times. The land of Israel is not particularly important in and of itself. The land of Israel is a way to get from one place to another. And if you look at the purple line here, right, the purple line is part of what's called the Via Maris, the sea route, which was an extremely important road in ancient times, in biblical times, later on in Roman times, right? And it's how you get from the major empire of Egypt to the major empires up in the northeast, right? Whether that's Assyria or Babylonia or the Hittites, depending on the time period. But where are you going? You're going out of Egypt, right? Up the coast, past Gaza, past Jaffa. You're going a little bit inland because you have swamps here, and ultimately crossing over by the Jezreel Valley and continuing further on. Okay, this is called Derech Hayam, the sea route, or in Tanakh, in the Torah, this is Derech Eretz Plishtim. This is the way of the Philistines. Remember, God says to Moses, I don't want to take you out Derech Eretz Plishtim, because you're going to be Penro Otam Milchama. You're going to see frightening things, whether that means the fortresses that the Egyptians put up so that slaves could not escape, which we know they did on this route, or whether it's because the Philistines are going to go to war with you. In any case, we don't go out that way, right? We go out this other way through the Sinai Desert and around. But this is a majorly important thoroughfare in ancient times. So that's just to give us a little bit of a sense of where we are, where we are going. I see there are a lot of comments. We're going to look at them all at the end. I hope there's nothing that is very, very urgent and pressing. Okay, this is a very broad timeline. We are talking about a lot of places over a lot of time periods, so don't think that I included everything. I really didn't include everything, but I did want us to get a sense of who are the peoples that we are talking about, right? When I said that you have throughout so many centuries Gentiles on the coast, Israelites, Jews in the mountains, who are these Gentiles? Who are these groups, right? And realize, and we'll see this as we go along, that in those Gentile cities, Ashkelon, Caesarea, Jaffa, there are Jews living as well. And it doesn't mean there aren't Jews. It's just that they are not Jewish cities. Jerusalem is a Jewish city throughout First and Second Temple times. Okay, Jaffa, Ashdod, Ashkelon are not Jewish cities, but Jews might live there, right? Toronto, New York, that's what we're talking about. Okay, so here we go. If we go back 4,000 years, right? Early Bronze Age, Middle Bronze Age, you have major Canaanite centers along the coast, also in the lowlands, but also along the coast. Places like Ashkelon and Jaffa, Afek, not exactly on the coast, but close enough.
Okay, oh gosh, it's think terrible.
Somebody mute yourself. I'll mute you.
Things
change very radically in 1200 BCE, right? Very, very important changes in the land of Israel. What happens is you have double invasions, right? You have children of Israel coming in from the east, right? With Joshua, the settlement of the land. You have the Philistines coming in from the west. And we're going to talk about the Philistines and where they come from, okay? But you have Philistine invasion and settlement mostly along the coast, although not only, okay? And that's the first, that's our second major population after the Canaanites, okay? As time goes on, another power comes along, the Phoenicians, okay? The Phoenicians settle the coast after the first temple is destroyed, after the Babylonians exile the Jews as well as the Philistines. Hey, the Phoenicians become an even more important power on the coast. However, like pretty much everybody except for us, hey, the Phoenicians are turned into Hellenists. They're turned into Greeks. Along comes Alexander the Great, conquers everything, brings this great, great Greek culture to everybody. And these cities, which have been Phoenician cities, they don't retain any special Phoenician identity. They become Hellenistic cities like everybody else. And from the middle of Second Temple times, 200 BCE and on, you have very important Greek and then later Roman centers in Ashkelon, in Akko, in Jaffa, right? These are important polises, right? Greek and later Roman cities. Okay? Herod steps in and creates his important city, Caesarea, at the end of the first century before the Common Era. Okay? All of these cities flourish, Roman rule, Byzantine rule, a little less so under the Muslims. The Muslims are not seafarers as much as they are land warriors, but the cities are still important. Trade is still important. But the next really significant period is the Crusades, right? And we're going to see the Crusaders mostly come from the sea. They need the sea. The sea is a lifeline for them, for people coming back and forth, supplies coming back and forth from Europe. So the coast is super important for them. Akko ultimately becomes their capital. And here's where we get to our probably the most important turning point in this whole timeline. Okay, 1291, after a few decades of conquest, one place after the other, falling like dominoes to the Mamluks, to these Muslim conquerors, to a guy named Baibars. Okay, Akko and Atlit are the last ones. Baibars makes a very, very significant decision. And that decision is to destroy the coastal cities. And that's where our flip happens. The coastal cities are destroyed. They are not lived in for centuries. The Muslims, the Mamluk rulers, and later the Ottomans move inland and they move into the mountains. What happens to the Jews? There aren't so many Jews left in the land of Israel by this point, right? They are still in places like Jerusalem and Hebron and Sfat, but they're overpowered by the Muslims who move inland and the coast stays destroyed, right? And that's where you get this fascinating flip, because even though you have some rebuilding in the 17th and the 18th century, much of the coast remains neglected, swampy, garbage land. Along come the Zionists at the end of the 19th century. They want to buy land. What's for sale? The coast. Nothing else is for sale. So they buy this land, and that's where you get this settlement, what we call Michadera Vil Ad Gedera, right? The new settlements come on the coast. And it's a fascinating flip in Jewish history. And we have Tel Aviv and we have Nahariya, and we're going to talk about all these places. But that's really what I want you to notice here, is this shift from a Gentile enclave to a Jewish enclave. What we're going to do is we're going to look through the history, right, through these different groups, the Philistines, the Phoenicians, etc. And then we're going to look at specific places along the way. Okay, so let's get going. Oh my gosh, 6:15 and we haven't even gotten going. All right. Philistines. Let's start with the Philistines. They're very well known. Of course, we know who the Philistines are. They are the major enemy of the Israelites in early First Temple times, right? The King Saul, King David, right? The major enemy. Eventually, they are subdued, but they don't disappear. They remain an important power until the destruction of the First Temple. When the Babylonians come along and exile us, they exile the Philistines as well. The Philistines, unlike us, do not come back, okay? But they remain a significant power throughout First Temple times. Tanakh tells us about, I don't want this yellow anymore. Tanakh tells us about the five cities, right? The Pentapolis of the Philistines, okay? Aza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gat, right? We did a whole class on the Philistines long, long ago in the winter, okay? But these are not the only Philistine cities. There are other places, and the more we explore, the more we discover that the Philistines were along the coast in other places, okay? Why did they take over the coast? Well, first of all, let's just understand for a second. This area is meant to be part of one of the tribes, right? If you know your tribal maps, you know that this is supposed to be part of the tribal area of Judah, right? Judah's supposed to go all the way from the Judean desert and all the way to the coast. This is what is written about in the book of Joshua. In reality, didn't really happen, okay? Very, very hard to kick out the Philistines. Yes, King David makes them less powerful than they were, but they're still a force and they remain a force throughout First Temple times. So they stick around and they are still important. Why do they settle the coast? Well, because of what we said before. The children of Israel are coming in from this direction. The Philistines are coming from the sea. Basically, they're coming from Egypt. They tried to take over in Egypt. They get thrown out by the Paro there, by Ramses II. So they move up the coast. Who's in the middle? Who has the really good farmland in the middle? That's the Canaanites. They have the good land. They have this very good farmland, the lowlands, very fertile, lots of water. And they stay there now for the next few hundred years. The Philistines and the Israelites are going to fight over that middle land. And that's why actually this is one of the most fascinating places in archaeology today, because it's shifting, right? Who takes it? When do they take it? How do they take it? But the Philistines, A, because they're coming in from the sea, and B, because they can't take this area because it's so heavily settled by the Canaanites, they take the coast. What's left to the children of Israel? What's left to them is the desert, not so great, and part of the mountains, and they have to figure out how to thrive in those areas, but that's a separate story, okay? So that's our Plishtim, our Philistines. They are coming in, they are settling on the coast, although not only on the coast, and they come, one of the major places they come to is Ashkelon, right? Ashkelon in the southern part of the coast. Just look back at our, we have it right here, right? Ashkelon over here, the middle city of the three on the coast. Hey, Ashkelon begins as a very powerful Canaanite city. As we're going to see, Ashkelon is a major trading center. It's a market city. The excavations that have been going on in Ashkelon the last few decades are amazing. They're finding incredible stuff that shows you the power of both the Canaanite city earlier and then the Philistine city that replaces it. And one of the truly astounding things that was discovered in Ashkelon, something similar was discovered in a Canaanite city in the north in Tel Dan, is this. In Tel Dan, it's perfectly preserved here. It's only partly preserved. But what you can see, the original here, this is obviously what's reconstructed, but you can see the remains of an arch, okay? This is an arch that goes back to Canaanite times. It's give or take 4,000 years old. Up until the arches in Ashkelon and in Tel Dan were discovered, everybody thought, who invented the arch? The Romans. This is almost 2,000 years earlier than the Romans. The Canaanites had very superior technology. They figured out how to do this. It's truly an incredible thing. So this was discovered at the entrance to Ashkelon, major city walls, defense systems, and this arch. Okay, lots of other stuff discovered, but one of the really special things that was discovered, I mean, somewhat disturbing, but important, okay, right near the walls of the city, in what we think was some kind of a ritual site right outside the walls, right? We know there were ritual sites outside the walls, people who came, travelers, they wanted to give thanks to the local gods and to their gods, and they found this little shrine, okay? This, two things, this little house, right? This is very small. It's like, I don't know, maybe a foot high, okay? They found this little house, and who's living in the little house? This little silver calf. Okay, who's a calf? A calf is one of the animals that is worshipped by the Canaanites. Why do we have a golden calf in Egypt? Because calves, cows, they're part of the local culture. They're part of the local idolatry. And this is what was found right outside the walls of Ashkelon. Now, the Philistines conquer Ashkelon, and they keep it as a major trade center. And one of the things that's fascinating about Ashkelon, if you look at the name of Ashkelon, inside the name of Ashkelon, you have the word shekel. Okay, shekel, we say today, we think of as a coin, but shekel really means lishkol, to weigh. right? You weights and measures. That's how you did business in the old days. You didn't have coins in the old days. You had a certain amount of silver, of gold, of barter, of whatever. So Ashkelon is the city of weights. It's the city where you go and you are doing all kinds of trades. And indeed, in the archaeology, as you can see in this picture on the right, they found, first of all, the marketplace of Ashkelon, which was on the beach, right? The traders come in. It's a big port. People come in from all over the world. They bring in their ships, and there's a marketplace literally right by the port, right on the beach. And we found the remains of it, all different kinds of weights, right? All different kinds of imported objects, and also objects that were meant for export, right? Plain pottery that we've sent out to other places. So Ashkelon is very much a trade center. Canaanite times, the Philistines continue it. If you remember, the Kina, right? The mourning poem that David says when Saul and Jonathan are killed, right? What does he say? Plishtim, Philistines, don't be proud of what you did. Al tagidu begat, al tivasru bechutzot Ashkelon. Don't tell it in Gat. Don't tell it in the markets. Chutzot is the markets of Ashkelon, right? Today, by the way, when you drive into Ashkelon, it's a little bit jarring, but right as you drive into the city, there's a huge mall that is called Chutzot Ashkelon, right? So we love to take our Tanakh and invert things, right? Ashkelon, by the way, just one more thing about Ashkelon. The assumption is, we don't know 100%, but we think that the scallion was invented in Ashkelon or was developed in Ashkelon, and that's where the word scallion comes from, Ashkelon. Okay, also very nice. So the Philistines are significant on the coast, but Ashkelon is a great example because of all the stuff that's being excavated there. Today they're doing a lot of new excavations in Ashdod. When we find out more there, we'll have to do a class on Ashdod. But let's move on to the Phoenicians. Okay, the Phoenicians is a name that was given to them by the Greeks. Okay, they didn't call themselves Phoenicians. They called themselves Sidonians. They called themselves Tyrians, right? They called themselves by whatever town they were from. The Greeks come along and say, no, you are the Phoenicians. What does the Phoenicians mean? Phoenicians literally means the people of the purple. Okay, we're going to see purple dye is one of the major products of the Phoenicians. Now, the Phoenicians really, they are not a nation of their own. They are not a unique ethnicity. They are Canaanites. They are the same Canaanites as the Canaanites in the land of Israel. They're just further up the coast. Okay, when we think about famous Phoenicians, right, we have a few famous Phoenicians. We have Hiram, the king of Tyre, right, who sends supplies to the temple. He's buddies with King Solomon. And less positively, we have Izebel, the wife of King Ahab, right? And what does she do? She's a princess. She's a Phoenician princess. And she brings her Baal worship, right? Which, of course, is the Canaanite gods. But it's a very important thing in Phoenicia, in Sidon, in Tyre, and she brings it with her, okay? So they are the same. They are the same ethnicity, the same religion, the same DNA as the Canaanites. Okay, and in fact, what they're best known for is they are master traders. The Phoenicians are master merchants. A Kna'ani in Tanakh, literally, what is a Kna'ani? A Canaanite, a trader. A merchant, right? In Eshet Chayil, right? The valiant woman, she sells her things to the Kna'ani. A Kna'ani is a trader. So the Phoenicians are the ultimate traders, unlike other powers in our region that spread their power through war. The Phoenicians also spread out, but they spread out through trade, right? Take a look at this great map, right? Here are their major cities in what's today Lebanon. Which, by the way, they did DNA studies on people in Lebanon today, and they found that we can trace their DNA going back. Many of them have the same DNA going back to the Phoenicians. Okay? But the Phoenicians spread out with their trade empire all along the Mediterranean, right? All the way to North Africa and to Carthage, right? All the way up towards Spain. This is all Phoenicia. They managed to spread all the way out here. And when we have in Roman times, we talk about the Punic Wars and Carthage. Punic is Phoenicians. That's who these guys are. So they spread out with their trade throughout the Mediterranean, but they settle as well on the coast. Right now, two of the things that they're famous for, we mentioned this already, the purple. Okay, dye in the old days is very difficult to make. It's exceedingly expensive, and it is only for the most important, the wealthiest, the elite, the royal. That's why we say royal blue. That's why we say born to the purple, right? Because only those people get to have colors. Who are the experts at purple, which is the most royal of all the colors? The Tyrians, okay? The people of Tyre. They are the ones who know how to make purple. Now, of course, this color is connected to Jews as well, because a variant of purple, if you take your purple dye, which comes from these murex snails that you see over here, and you add certain components to it, you add certain chemicals, and you leave it out in the sun, you get not purple, but tchelet, right? That bright shade of blue that needs to be the fringe of your tzitzit, right? One of the threads of your tzitzit, of your ritual fringes, needs to be tchelet. And the rabbis knew all about this, and they knew about how you got authentic tchelet and there was fake tchelet, right? And we will go into it, but it's a fascinating story. But the guys who are the most proficient at this technology are the people of Tzor and Sidon. So that's where they get their name, Phoenicians. And we know that there the snails are all along the coast. Today you can go dive for the snails by Dor on the coast, but also by Lebanon, of course. The other thing that they are known for, and we hear about this in rabbinic literature, is that they have a particularly reliable mint. Okay, in ancient times, every municipality, not every municipality, but a lot of kings and a lot of empires made their own coins. And as the nature of these things go, some were better and some were worse, right? Just like today, you'd rather have, you know, a dollar, well, maybe not anymore, right, than a kopeck. Hey, in the old days, you would rather have your silver coming from Tyre, because their silver was, their mint was considered to be one of the highest qualities, meaning the best silver, the most silver. It wasn't debased with other metals. And the rabbis talk about this when they talk about bringing your donation of a half shekel to the temple, the machatita shekel. What does it have to be? It has to be a shekel. It has to be coming from Tyre, Tyrian silver. Okay? And that's exactly what this is here, a coin that is a half shekel, one of the Tyrian silver coins. So the Phoenicians are very well known for these things. Ultimately, like I said, they all become Hellenized. They all become Greek. And these coastal cities become Greek and then Roman. Okay? And we see this all over the coast, right? We see it, we'll see it in Caesarea in a minute, in Herod's city that he builds from the ground up, but it's very much a Roman city. We see it in Dor, and we see it in Akko, and we see it in the two pictures that I brought you here. Okay, this picture on the left here is from Ashkelon. Okay, Ashkelon. Not only is the Canaanite and Philistine stuff fascinating, but the later stuff is fascinating as well. And one of the major reasons that people started to excavate in Ashkelon was because there was this English explorer, this English lady named Lady Hester Stanhope, who shows up in the 19th century in Ashkelon, and she unearths all of these statues. She was a real adventurer, and she finds all these statues of various, whether they were Roman gods and goddesses or Egyptian gods and goddesses. It's very, very diverse, very multicultural. Okay. Today we've excavated and we found the Cardo, the main street. We found this round, this is where this is found, this round building called the Bulletarion, where we think the city council used to sit, right? And Roman Ashkelon is a very important city. Are there Jews living there? There are indeed Jews living there, but it is a very complicated city. We have quite a few stories for the rabbis from Ashkelon that give us a sense of this very mixed city, right? Not all of them positive. We do have some positive, right? The exemplar of taking care of your parents, of respecting your parents. Kibbutz Av Va'em is a guy named Dama ben Netina, whose father was sleeping with a precious jewel under his head. And when the rabbis came to buy it from him from the temple, he said, no, my father's taking a nap. I can't wake him up, right? He's considered to be the exemplar of respecting your parents. He's not Jewish, and he's from Ashkelon. On the other hand, we have stories about witches in Ashkelon that are captured by Shimon ben Shetach. We have stories about conflict between the Jews and the Gentiles in Ashkelon. So it's a very complicated city, okay? But it definitely has a Jewish population, just not a Jewish population whose life is always easy. When is the life of a Jew easy? The other city that you have here, the other picture you have here, is from Jaffa. Hey, now Jaffa, also fascinating city, very much a coastal city, Canaanite, Philistine, Phoenician, Greek, Roman. Josephus tells us about how the Greeks in the time of Judah Maccabee attack the Jews. In the time of the Romans, the Jews are attacked again, and yet there is a Jewish community in the city. Very clearly, there's a Jewish community in the city, and in the very limited excavations that were done in Jaffa, and that's what you're looking at here in the visitor center in Jaffa, they uncovered a house that had two levels, one from the time of the Hasmoneans, from the time of the story of Hanukkah, and then a later level from the first century of the Common Era, and this is clearly in both eras, in both periods, this is a Jewish house. Okay? How do I know that? Because they found stone vessels, which tell you that the owner of the house was very concerned about purity, because they actually found an inscription in the house that says Judah, Yehuda. Okay? And this is a house that belongs to Jews. So you have this very interesting city that is a pagan city and then a Christian city, but has Jews living in it, similar to what we're going to see in Caesarea. When we get to Caesarea, we'll come back to it. But let's continue a little bit with our historical story. Okay, so these cities flourish Roman times, Byzantine times, and then along come the Crusaders. Okay, first crusade proclaimed in Europe in 1096. They finally get to the land of Israel in 1099. They conquer Ashkelon. They continue on towards Jerusalem in a bloody, terrible massacre and conquest. They take Caesarea in 1101. Okay, the Crusaders need the sea. They need the coast for very obvious reasons, because this is where their reinforcements and their strength are coming from. So they need to control the cities of the coast, and they conquer them one by one. Now, some cities they are able to hold on to, right? Saladin in 1187 takes them back, but Richard the Lionhearted gets them back again very quickly. Other cities pass back and forth, right? So take a look at the picture on the right. This is a picture of Caesarea, the crusader city of Caesarea. We're going to go backwards to Herod in a few minutes, okay? But this is the crusader city of Caesarea. They conquer it. They build a moat and walls around it. It's a much smaller city than the Roman city, but it's a strong and a fortified city. The picture on the left is a fascinating picture. This is a picture from Ashkelon, okay? Ashkelon was fought over quite a bit. The crusaders take it from the Muslims. The Muslims take it back from the crusaders. The Crusaders take it back again. Ultimately, it's taken by the Muslims and it's destroyed completely. But the picture tells you that story much more eloquently, because what is this? This is a piece of the walls of Ashkelon. If you go to the Ashkelon National Park today, you can see these ruined walls along the coast, and parts of it are tumbled down. It's really phenomenal. Okay? But this is a part of the wall that was found actually on the beach. And what you can see on it is Arabic writing, right? You can see the Arabic writing. And then somebody came along and put his graffiti on top. Okay. This is a crusader who came along and said, "Ha, Arabs, you think you rule here? You're wrong. This is now a crusader property, and I am going to etch my herald, my crest on top." Now, there actually was a scholar from, I believe, from Hebrew University, who was a scholar of medieval British history, and he went back and he researched this, and he figured out who was the guy who did the graffiti. It's a family in England. The guy's name, he found out that there really was someone from this family who went on the Crusades. His name was Hugh of Wake, and this is his family crest, and this is what he did. So it's just a great visual of this back and forth between the Crusaders and the Muslims. The most important city that the Crusaders take is Akko in the north, right? In the northern tip of the coast, they come along, they take it in 1104, and they start to build it up in a phenomenal way. Saladin, the Muslim conqueror, takes it back in 1187, but only for 4 years. And then along comes Richard the Lionhearted, right, of Robin Hood fame, comes along, and 4 years later in 1191, he takes it back. And what happens then is something that's fascinating, right? With Richard the Lionhearted, with the Third Crusade, Jerusalem is not regained. Okay, they regain Ashkelon, they regain Caesarea, and they regain Akko, but they don't get back Jerusalem. Jerusalem stays in Muslim hands, but Akko becomes the capital, the crusader capital of the land of Israel. But they don't call it the capital of the land of Israel. They call it the capital of the kingdom of Jerusalem. We don't have Jerusalem. We will one day. Don't worry, right? So Akko is the capital of the kingdom of Jerusalem. Now, Akko is a fascinating city. Already in the 1950s, Israel understood that there was incredible stuff underneath the ground. They managed to get it declared a UN site. There wasn't UNESCO World Heritage in the 50s, but something similar. But it took a very long time to excavate. Akko is a very complicated city. We'll see why in a moment. But today you can go and you can really see the most unbelievable things. They've unearthed these incredible fortresses, these urban fortresses, basically. And what you're seeing here are two of the most phenomenal things. On the left here is almost completely intact, the Hospitaller Fortress, right? The Hospitaller Knights. They created a huge area with dining hall, with a church, with a crypt, with a dungeon for people who misbehaved, right? With toilets, with everything. Okay? The other thing you're seeing here is something that was discovered completely by accident, as so many things are. Okay? There was a plumbing issue in the city about 20 years ago, and they uncovered this incredible tunnel built by the Knights Templar, right? Another one of the Crusader groups that came along and built here. Now, Akko is a fascinating city because this is a model of the Crusader, of the Hospitaller complex. And this is the toilets. Toilets are always interesting to see, right? So this is the toilets in the Hospitaller complex. You can see here, these are the toilet seats, right? Very nice. Not too bad for a knight who, you know, probably didn't have too many amenities. And they actually had a whole plumbing system and they realized that the toilets actually went out, were flushed out to sea. It was very sophisticated. Okay. But Akko is a fascinating Crusader site because unlike fortresses that were just fortresses, right, on a hilltop, and they were controlled by whether it was the Templars or the Hospitallers or all these different groups, Akko was a city. And that meant that one group had one piece and another group had another piece. And you had Venetian knights and you had French knights and you had all different kinds of knights, each one controlling his own little piece of territory, not always getting along with each other. And you had locals, because realize all these knights are coming here. They're marrying local women. They're not staying, single all the time. So they're marrying local women. So you have Christians and you have Arabs who are local, right? Muslims who eventually are converted, right? And you also have Jews. And ironically, the Crusaders who want to ethnic cleanse everything, and literally do, they massacre people, right? But Akko becomes a very multicultural place. It's very ironic, right? And it becomes so multicultural that it becomes a Jewish Mecca. And because the Crusaders are traveling back and forth and it becomes safer to travel back and forth, super ironically, the Crusaders, who hated the Jews and were the worst of the anti-Semites, actually makes Akko into a place that Jews start to come to. So, for example, we have this amazing testimony of the Rambam, of Maimonides, who was born in Spain, has to escape from Spain to North Africa, ultimately makes his life in Egypt, okay? But he does come to the land of Israel when he's 30 years old in 1165, right? And he writes here, and on the first day of the week, on the third day of Sivan, I saw the sea, I came to Akko and was saved from apostasy and arrived in the land of Israel, right? And he celebrates this day for the rest of his life as a day that he's redeemed and he's saved. And he goes to Hebron, he goes to Jerusalem, right? Et cetera, et cetera. The Rambam, Maimonides, doesn't stay in the land of Israel, but we have others who do, prominent among them, the Ramban, Nachmanides, right? Who's kicked out of Spain because he dares to dispute with the, he's forced to dispute with the Christians, and he dares to win, and he comes to the land of Israel. First he goes to Jerusalem, then he continues on to Akko, and he rebuilds the community there, okay? And in his commentary, he writes about how the land is only fertile when the Jews come back to it, right? Very, very powerful. You have other great rabbis, Yechiel of Paris, the 300 rabbis from France who come. And Akko really, very ironically, has a Jewish renaissance. And later on, we hear about other people like Rabbi Nachman of Breslov coming. So Akko, which seems to be the most crusader, the most Christian of these cities, actually has quite a Jewish connection. But let's move on in our story, okay? the Mamluks, the Muslim elite soldiers led by Baibars, the ultimate warrior, they come and they are successful in driving the Crusaders out of the land of Israel. Saladin in 1187 has a short-lived victory, but it's really Baibars who has the longer victory, and he manages to conquer the Crusader fortresses, and they fall one by one, the 1260s, the 1270s, the 1280s. You're looking at here on the left, the fortress of Apollonia, right near today's Herzliya, right? Powerful Crusader fortress on the beach at Jaffa. Here on the right, hey, one by one, they fall. Ashkelon falls and Caesarea falls. And the final ones to fall are in the north, Atlit, okay, a little bit south of Haifa today, and Akko. Okay, 1291, the Crusaders have left the land of Israel, and Baibars makes this very momentous decision. And he writes about how it pains him because these cities are so beautiful. But he says, I'm going to destroy the coast because I don't want the Crusaders to come back. And if we don't have any access on the coast, if there are no more ports on the coast, they can't come back. And one by one, he destroys Ashkelon and Jaffa and Caesarea and Akko, and they become ruins. And for centuries afterwards, they are ruins. And that's what you're seeing here in the picture. And the picture on the right is a modern picture, but it's part of the Crusader port of Akko. Right, and we'll tell the end of the story of Akko in a minute. Okay, the picture on the left is the ruins of Ashkelon in the 19th century. This is a painting from the 19th century that's still very much a city in ruins. And these towns along the coast, some of them revive. We're going to see Akko and Jaffa. Some of them, until 1948, they are small fishing villages, and Ashkelon is one of those, right? Caesarea as well. And it's just this very momentous decision. What happens in Akko? So Akko is a fascinating city, because what happens in Akko is it's too valuable a city. And by the 18th century, the Ottoman Turks come back, and a ruler called Dahar al-Omar comes back and decides that they are going to rebuild Akko. But the problem with Akko is that you have these massive ruins. We saw what the Crusaders built, right? We saw that massive Hospitaller fortress. How can you, there are no bulldozers. So what they did is they built a second city 12 meters above the first. And it's truly an astonishing thing. And when they excavated, they really found this. What the Ottomans did is they built massive arches on top of the Crusader ruins. And then they built their city on top. So essentially, you have two cities, one above the other. The Ottoman city, which is what you see when you walk around in the old city of Akko today, right? And it includes things like the Al-Jazar Mosque that you see here on the right, this massive mosque. But below it, in the archaeology that's been uncovered in the last 50 years, you have the Crusader city right below. And it's truly an astounding thing. The fellow in the middle, who is not particularly sympathetic, his name was Ahmed Al-Jazar. Al-Jazar was his nickname. It means the butcher. It's not a particularly complimentary nickname. He was a great builder. He's the one who builds the mosque. This is the Al-Jazar Mosque. He builds a lot in Akko. He allows the Jews to come back. He even has his most trusted advisor is a guy named Chaim Farchi, a Jewish advisor, but he's very cruel. He trusts Chaim Farchi, but when he doesn't like him, he cuts off his ear, his nose, right? But between him and Chaim Farchi, they managed to defeat the next major crisis that happens to Akko, and that's Napoleon, who wants to conquer Akko in his move towards world domination, where he comes from Egypt and he moves up the coast and he takes Gaza and Jaffa and he makes his way towards Akko, and that's where he's defeated, right, by Jazar and by the British. The British Admiral Sidney Smith, and he's turned back. Also a very significant moment. Let's look back at Jewish Akko for a second. So in the 1700s, when Akko is being rebuilt, you have certain insignificant Jewish personalities who come along. And one of them is one of the most interesting Jewish personalities of the early modern period. And this is the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who really was a true Renaissance man. He was renowned. Well, he wasn't renowned. That's part of his story. He should have been renowned in many different fields. He was a brilliant Hebrew writer. He was a mystic, and he was a Musar. He's one of the earliest writers of what we call Musar literature, ethical literature. The most famous book he writes is called The Path of the Just, Misilat Yesharim, where he writes in just plain, straight-talking language how to be a better person. And it's a classic still today. Now, he's a brilliant man, and he writes in Italian, and he writes in Hebrew, and he writes beautiful poetry, and everybody hates him. Everybody hates him. They think that he's a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. They don't like him. Nobody likes him, and he's hounded from place to place until he finally shows up in Akko, and he lives. He finally gets to Akko. He's able to live in relative peace, and along comes the plague, and as you can see, he dies very young. So, terrible life that he has after his death. Naturally, everybody claims him, right? So the Enlightenment Hebrew writers look at him and they say, wow, what an incredible writer. And the mystics look at his mystical works. And the Misnagdim, who like the ethical literature, take on his ethical works, right? But in his lifetime, he had a very miserable life. But he does come to Akko. And he establishes a synagogue, which has today been renovated, and you can go visit it. And it's the only synagogue, the only ancient synagogue deep within the old city of Akko, which is a very Arab and a Muslim and Christian place. But today there's, we've all been following the news. We know what happened in Akko in May, a lot of riots from the Arabs against the Jewish population. But in general, there is a stronger Jewish population in Akko, and it's growing. And usually there's coexistence in Akko. But you can go and see the synagogue today. And one of the highlights of the synagogue is the Sefer Torah, which you can see here in the middle. First of all, it's the Torah that goes back to the Ramchal. But what makes it even more unusual, you can see it's kind of a strange color. That's not because it's old. It's because it's written on deerskin. Okay, you can write a Torah on the hide of any kosher animal. Most Torahs are not written on anything other than cows or calves, but this is written on deer skin with ink made out of pomegranates. So it's really a very unusual Torah. So that's the Ramchal. Another famous visitor, not a settler, but a visitor to Akko is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who as a very young man comes to the land of Israel. Unfortunately, he comes just as Napoleon comes. He's caught in the crossfire. He's terrified. He writes about it. He manages to get passage on a ship and get out of there as fast as he can. But he also comes to Akko. And finally, one last thing in Akko, before we move on, is the very, very formidable prison that's built by the Ottoman Turks when they rebuild the city. And this is a prison that is then taken over by the British and is much more famous under the British, because this is where they put various famous Jewish personalities like Zeev Jabotinsky. This is where you have the famous Akko prison breakout of the Irgun and the Lehi in the 1940s. So a very significant part of the story of Akko. But let's move on to Caesarea, okay? Caesarea, Caesarea, the city that's built out of nothing, basically. Along comes Herod 2,000 years ago, says, I need a port. Why do I need a port? Because a port is a very good moneymaker. He doesn't want to use any of the existing ports because he doesn't have particular rights over them. So he creates a port out of nothing. Now, most ports are in a place that's naturally protected. Caesarea is not naturally protected. That doesn't bother Herod. He doesn't care about nature. He can overcome nature. And he creates his own breakwater. What he does is he fills wooden crates with volcanic ash. He tows them out to sea. He lets them sink. Okay? Volcanic ash mixed with water becomes concrete. And they create an artificial breakwater, which creates this very significant port. Now, in order to make Caesarea not just a port, but a real city, Herod builds an amazing Roman city around it with aqueducts. Ducks bringing in fresh water, because you have the sea, but you don't have fresh water. So that's what you see here in the picture on the left, with his own palace. This is the private swimming pool that he had filled with fresh water inside the sea, which is pretty wild, with a theater, with an amphitheater, with a VIP port, right? Caesarea is truly an incredible place. And the excavations that have been done in the last few decades have really shown what it is, right? A complete Roman city, soup to nuts, everything you could possibly want. But what happens is, again, when the Mamluks come, the city, which had already kind of fallen somewhat on hard times, pretty much sinks into the sea. And it needs to be rediscovered. Now, even before the excavations that are begun here in the 50s and 60s, people are finding things, right? People are finding things because there was so much here that even with the looting that took place and the destruction, there's just so much. So when you have a kibbutz that's built just south of the ancient ruins of Caesarea, right? Sdot Yam, Sdot Yam, famous for being the home of Chana Senesh, the paratrooper. The kibbutznikim, when they're working the fields and when they're going and they're fishing, they just keep finding stuff. They keep finding statues of Roman goddesses and ancient vessels. And there's a little museum in Sdot Yam, which is just the stuff that they found in the course of their everyday lives. And this is before there was any kind of serious excavation. So Caesarea is truly an incredible story. But let's get to our modern story. Okay. And this is what we said before. Okay. The Mamluks move inland. The coast is neglected. Along come the Zionists with the first Aliyah, with the second Aliyah, looking to buy land at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century. What's available to them? This garbage land on the coast, as well as the garbage land in the Jezreel Valley, which is also very much neglected, right? Incredibly fertile land that's neglected and turns into swamps. And if you look at this map, I think this map tells the story better than anything else. This is all the black is Jewish land possession in up until 1930. Okay, so you can see that it's almost all the coast, the Jezreel Valley, and a little bit of the Eastern Galilee. The whole historical area of Judea and Samaria, almost nothing. Almost nothing, a little bit north of Jerusalem. Gush Etzion is not 1930. We don't have yet the communities of Gush Etzion. We have, and they were destroyed, right? The Negev is not built up at all. And it's really all of this land along the coast and the valleys. Hey, and this is that modern return coming back, but not coming back to the places where we were before. And that's why a lot of times when we describe the early settlement, we talk about from Gedera, right? Gedera is about here, to Hadera, right over here, right? That's the early settlement. Only later do we expand into the mountains. And a lot of that only happens after the Six-Day War, by the way. Hey, one of the most significant early settlements, of course, is Tel Aviv. And this is this great iconic picture of the lottery of land for the first area, the first neighborhood called Achuzat Bait, which becomes Tel Aviv. And you can see there's nothing. It's sand dunes. There's nothing there. Okay? The Zionists begin. They come back. They're building in places like Neve Tzedek, right outside of Jaffa. Right, Jaffa already has been rebuilt, but also all of these early communities, Rishon LeZion and Rehovot and Zichron Yaakov, not on the coast, but very, very close to the coast. Okay? But the first real city, the first Hebrew city is Tel Aviv. Right? Along comes a Jewish pioneer named Akiva Aryeh Weiss, a religious guy, comes to the land of Israel for the first time in 1904. While he's on the ship, he hears of the terrible news that Theodor Herzl has died. And when he lands, he says, that's it. We have to do something to commemorate Herzl. And the day after he arrives, right, he's this new immigrant. He's this total greenhorn. He calls a meeting. We need to create the first Hebrew city, right? Lots of chutzpah, okay? But he calls a meeting. And indeed, 5 years later, in 1909, the first Hebrew city is founded. And it's the community, the organization that created, and that's these guys here. This is already 20 years later. This is 1929. It's called Achuzat Bait. But the city itself becomes known as Tel Aviv. Tel from ancient, right? The archaeological site. Aviv from spring. It's also a place in the book of Ezekiel. But they call it that because it's the old and the new. And you can see here the early Tel Aviv with the two major streets, Rothschild Boulevard, right? Going east to west. And Herzl Street, right? Herzl is the visionary. Rothschild is the money guy. You need both of those. And that's the beginnings of Tel Aviv. Okay? The centerpiece of the city. Can you see it in this picture? Yes, but not really very well. Okay. What's the most important building in this early city? Everybody gets a nice little plot with a garden. But the most important building is the Gymnasia Ivrit, the Hebrew high school, because of course, this is the first Hebrew city. And the most important building is where we're going to have this new Hebrew culture and education. And it's this beautiful building at the center, at the center of the town. It's a building that exists until the early 60s, when the municipality of Tel Aviv, in the interests of progress and in its wisdom, tears down this beautiful building and builds the Shalom Tower, which some people may remember as being the first skyscraper in the Middle East, right? It really was. It really was a skyscraper. I remember coming here in the 80s and they'd say, oh, you have to go to the Shalom Tower and go up to the top. It is 30 something stories high. Okay. Today, it's not even the tallest building on its block. But when it was built, it was the biggest building, not in Israel, in the Middle East. Okay. There was no UAE. There was no Dubai. They didn't have any of these buildings, but it's an incredibly ugly building. And they tore down a historical building to build it, which is very sad, but that is what they did in the 60s. Let us move a little further north to Haifa. Okay, Haifa is known as the city that works, right? Jerusalem is the city that prays and Tel Aviv is the city that plays, but Haifa is the city that works. Okay? It's got this very significant deep water port. There was always a port in Haifa. In ancient times, there was a port as well. Today, it's not in exactly the same place, but this is a deep water port that huge container ships can come into. Haifa is built on the remains of earlier, much more ancient settlements, but it really expands in the late 19th century with the German Templars. And then with the coming of the British, it becomes a really major center because of the port, because of the train system that goes from Beirut to Haifa, from Haifa to Damascus. So hard to imagine these things today, because of the oil pipeline that came from Iraq to Haifa. Okay, so in British times, Haifa really becomes a major player. And it still today is very much a city of industry, of technology. You have the refineries here on the left. This is an old picture. One of them collapsed a few years ago. And Haifa also has a lot of environmental challenges, but we're not going to go into that right now. When the British leave, Haifa is always a mixed city, and we're going to see that in a moment. When the British leave and the fighting breaks out, the Haganah takes the city. They tell the Arabs that they should stay. There are a lot of Arab residents of Haifa, but the Mufti, the leader of the Arabs in the land of Israel, says, no, 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 pick yourselves up and leave and you'll come back and you'll inherit the whole city. And they do leave. Some of them do eventually come back. But Haifa becomes a Jewish city and it becomes the gateway of the massive immigration. Okay, Israel in its first 5 years has a huge, huge immigration, doubles its population. And many, many, many of those immigrants come through Haifa. And in Haifa, by the port, is this area that's called Shar HaAliyah, the gateway of immigration. You need a place to process all these people. How are they going to, they're eventually going to be sent to other places, but first they have to come in and you have to process them. And you have to figure out who they are and where they're going to go. And you need basic hygiene and food. So they create this huge camp called the Shar HaAliyah, which at its height had thousands of people passing through every day. In the first year of statehood, over 100,000 people passed through Shar HaAliyah. Ultimately, after the great waves of immigration, it becomes a regular neighborhood. But here's, you're seeing it at its height in the beginning, when people are just passing through, these waves and waves of humanity coming into the land of Israel. Of course, with these many, many different groups coming in from many places, you have ethnic tensions. And these tensions come to a boil at the end of the 50s in a neighborhood called Wadi Salib in downtown Haifa. Jews coming from Arab countries, getting very, almost always getting worse treatment than Jews coming from European countries. And ultimately, the tensions build up and build up and build up until a policeman is attacked. He shoots one of the members, one of the Mizrahi Jews in Wadi Salib. Riots break out there and all over the country. Ultimately, a commission of inquiry. Ultimately, conditions get better. But this is part of the story of Israel in the 50s and of the ethnic tensions that are going on. Haifa today is a very diverse city. Okay, just to give you numbers, 68% Jews, that's already very unusual, okay, that you have not, you know, a larger number, a larger percentage of Jews. 6% are Muslims, 6% are Arab Christians, 2% are Druze, and then 20% are considered others, okay? Whether they are a Muslim sect called the Ahmadis, which is their mosque that you're seeing here on the left, whether it's the Baha'i Christians who are not Arabs, right? So you have, it's a very interesting, very diverse, and mostly very tolerant of all different groups, city, religious, secular, and as we said, many different religions. You have a picture here of the Druze, the Ahmadis, and of course, probably the most prominent thing that you see in Haifa is built by the Baha'i. Okay, the Baha'i, one of the world's newest religions, founded in the middle of the 19th century. One of their principles is beauty. Their main prophet is called the Baha'u'llah. He's imprisoned by the Turks in Akko for many years, and ultimately he dies in Akko. Before his death, he decides that the major shrine of the Baha'i, including the grave of the founder of Baha'i, the Bab, the forerunner of the Baha'u'llah, should be in Haifa. It takes about 100 years, but then these gardens are built from the late 80s till 2000, and they are the centerpiece, the most beautiful thing in Haifa, something that everybody goes to see today, and really an incredible vista that you can see going from the top of the Carmel all the way down to the port. Okay, last two places that we're going to talk about. One is Nahariya. As you drive north along the coast, you go past Akko, you're getting close to Lebanon, you come to this cute little resort town called Nahariya. Okay, Nahariya was founded in the 30s, largely German Jewish families, right? Think about the 30s, a lot of German Jews coming to the land of Israel. It's built on the banks of the Gaaton River, which actually runs through the town down to the sea. Of course, it's built on the beach. They try agriculture. Agriculture is not super successful. And so Nahariya becomes two things. It becomes a factory town, right? And the most famous factories are what you see here on the right, Zoglobek, the meat factory, and its counterpart, Strauss, which is dairy and ice cream, right? So you have the Milchik side of the street and the Fleischik side of the street, right? But these are German Jewish families, and they are very successful. There's another later industrialist, Steff Wertheimer, who comes from Nahariya. So factories are very important, but it also is built as a resort town, which it still is to a certain extent, right? Nice little pensionim or zimmerim, nice places to stay by the beach, very neat, very clean, very yekish, right? German Jews. This is the water tower that was the symbol of the city. And finally, slightly north of Nahariya, you drive another 10 minutes till you can't go anymore because you'll leave the country, and you get to Rosh HaNikra, which is really one of the most beautiful places in Israel. I think there's no disagreement about that. You get to this amazing white cliffs. And if you go down in the rickety cable car down to the bottom, you walk through these gorgeous grottos that were created by tectonic shifts, cracks in the sea wall that were then widened by the waves pounding against them for millennia. And it's really a fabulous place. This, you know, you're driving along the coast, you're driving, and you get to this wall, right? The rabbis were aware of this wall as well. They didn't call it Rosh HaNikra. That's actually a Hebraicization of the Arabic name, Ras al-Nikura, the head of all the grottos. The rabbis called it the Ladder of Tyre, Sulama Shel Tzor. In order to get to Tyre, you have to climb up the ladder and come out the other side. And it's very clear that they were familiar with it. They used it as a route to go north, and they know this place very well. Today, it's on the border, and there's actually an army base. It's not just a tourist site, but if you go up there, you'll see you have this, you know, nice sign telling you how many kilometers to Jerusalem, how many kilometers to Beirut, but there's also an army base up there. In the 40s, up until 1948, there were train tracks. There still are train tracks there, but there was a train that went from Haifa all the way to Beirut in 1948. For obvious reasons, Israel bombs the tracks and doesn't allow any trains to go through. But it reminds us of a time when the Middle East was more connected, and maybe that time will come again. And the coast is very much part of that story of different groups coming in, settling part of the land of Israel on the edge of the land of Israel. So it's really incredibly beautiful, but also a fascinating place. Let's take a look at some questions. Go back to the beginning here. Okay, fine. These are all about emails. I don't care about that. That's for Rabbi Kalman. Okay. Yes, we do need agricultural lands 100%, but the satellites is just to show you where are people living, right? I'm not saying that it's always good that there are people living everywhere, but it's just to give you a sense of where people are living. Hey, some rabbinic authorities say Yam HaGadol is the Atlantic. I don't know what they could possibly be basing that on, but you can tell me, because the Atlantic is not a reality of the rabbis. Maybe today, right? But certainly not in rabbinic times. You could see both the Mediterranean and the Atlantic. Okay, that's a good pshara. The Philistines were kicked out of Egypt. Where were they before they tried to get into Egypt? Thank you, Susanna. I sort of forgot that. There were too many things to talk about. Hey, they are coming from further west, right? From the Greek islands. There is a massive migration connected to the fact that the volcano on Santorini erupts and everybody's looking for places to be. And there's just a movement of populations from the Greek islands. They go towards Egypt and eventually they end up by us. Hey, did the Israelites in the desert purchase their tehillah from the Phoenicians? That's an interesting question. I have no answer for that, but they're definitely not making it in the desert because you need snails. The purple is the argaman. Yes, purple is argaman. Tehillah is blue. On biblical maps, you see Phoenicia north of the Galilee. Right. Phoenicia is, like I said, it's not the biblical name. You don't see that name in Tanakh. If you were to go to Izebel and say, what's your land? What's your nation? She would not say Phoenician. She would not have ever heard of that term. It's a Greek term, but that's how we define it. Okay.
Tzor v'Tzidon.
What?
Tzor v'Tzidon.
Tzor v'Tzidon, exactly, not Phoenicia. Phoenicia is not a Tanakh name. My uncle Avi Tabori was a prisoner in Akko under the British. Cool, you have to tell our story. I had a neighbor who was in that prison also. We should have a reunion. Yes, the gymnasia is not a Jewish architecture. That's for sure. Nothing is very much Jewish architecture. Haifa, the city that works at a David Broza song. It could be. I'm not familiar with it. Haifa is famous for the fact that buses run on Shabbos. Yes, that is part of the whole tolerance issue. You might not like it, but that is definitely part of the story there, that Haifa is a city that there has been an agreement among the various people who live there that you can have buses on Shabbat. Yes, you can definitely get wet in the grottos. Yes, you could. I don't know if you could cross the border, perhaps. I don't know. Rome was in Britain. Rabbis and Chazal were in Roman times. The Yam HaGadol is most definitely in Tanakh is the Yam HaTichon. There is no question about that. Were Chazal also aware of the Atlantic? Perhaps, but the Yam HaGadol is the Mediterranean. Did the Phoenicians consider themselves to be a people or a nation? That's a very interesting question. I think that the cities have their own identities. I think that they shared a religious identity. Later on, do they consider themselves part of something larger? That's a very interesting question. I don't know. I know, like, let's say we have inscriptions, like we have an inscription in the town of Maresha, where the guy calls himself the chief of the Sidonians, right? He still considers himself, he's a long way from Sidon, but he considers himself the chief of the Sidonians. So that's interesting. I do not know. Other questions, other comments?
The railway on Rosh HaNikra.
Yes.
I came in on that. On by train from Budapest in the beginning of 1944.
Wow, that's wild. Thank you for sharing that with us. Mm-hmm. And you went all the way to Haifa?
Yes.
Because wow, thank you for sharing that.
Syria, no, it was Istanbul, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Haifa.
That's amazing.
And before that, Budapest, Bucharest, Bulgaria, and then Istanbul.
I never met anybody who told me that they came in on that train. Thank you so much for telling me that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to Shuli and to both of you and to everybody for being here.